I want to read you four brief quotes from Rachel Carson, who was a woman who cared deeply about the environment and wrote about it often. You may know her book, Silent Spring. First quote, she says, "It is a wholesome and necessary thing for us to turn again to the earth and in the contemplation of her beauties to know a sense of wonder and humility." She said, "Those who contemplate the beauty of the earth find reserves of strength that will endure as long as life lasts. There is something infinitely healing," she said, "in the repeated refrains of nature, the assurance that dawn comes after night and spring after winter." And finally, "It is not half so important to know as to feel. To drink in the beauty of the natural world and wonder at the meaning of what you see." So even though I know that Rachel Carson was a marine biologist, she was a science and nature writer in a very technical, secular context. She wrote for the Baltimore Sun and wrote technical articles for the U.S. Bureau of Fisheries before writing books. I know this, and yet when I read her quotes, they sound to me like someone who is praying out loud at church. She has such an all-consuming reverence for ocean life, for birds. And reverence is no passing thin emotion. Reverence means that you feel a bone-deep respect, awe, and tenderness towards something. Reverence is the kind of word that you use when you are trying to explain a spiritual experience. And yet, I couldn't find a whole lot of detail about Rachel Carson's religious beliefs. I found an article from Indiana University saying that she was raised Presbyterian and had, quote, "contact off and on with the Unitarian Church," unquote. But I ask you to feel a sense of amazement and wonder when you consider existence. Do you need to believe in God? We'll get to that in a little bit. But first, I want to tell you a story that I read this week about a selfless act of kindness. There's this woman named Martha who is in her late 50s. She lives in California. And Martha has been an athlete all of her life. She runs marathons, she kayaks all the time, plays tennis and volleyball. But one morning, Martha woke up and her ankles were swollen and filled with a liquid. So she immediately went to the doctor because she's obviously not used to her body acting up. And the doctor told her, "Your kidneys are only operating at 15%. So Martha, within just a week, went from feeling like an invincible athlete to being on dialysis and growing weaker and weaker because she felt so defeated. Her identity felt shattered. So as she was growing weaker, the doctors also told her that it would probably take up to 3 years to find someone who matched her blood type and could donate a kidney to her. Well, meanwhile, at her local gym, Martha had always played tennis when she could with this guy named Charlie. They usually ended up being doubles partners if the weather was nice. And they got along. They were both quick and athletic. But they never hung outside of the gym together. They never hung out together. Charlie was in his 30s and had a young family, and Martha was approaching retirement. Their lives were just going different ways. But Charlie hadn't seen Martha in a while, and so he started asking their gym acquaintances some questions about where she was, and they told him what was going on. So soon after that, Charlie went and found where Martha was living, and he told her that if they were a good match, he'd donate a kidney to her. Obviously, Martha was stunned. But sure enough, they were a match. And so Charlie went on a very specific diet for a year and then underwent the surgery to give his kidney, one of his kidneys, to Martha. Charlie donated an organ to a casual acquaintance at the gym. Now, I read about this in a magazine, so I have no idea if Charlie is religious or if he is, in what way. But I wonder if to be that earth-shakingly kind, to be so radically generous to a familiar stranger, to be good, to live a moral life of that magnitude, do you have to believe in God? And we will get to that in a moment, but I'm going to tell you one more story. Carl Sagan was an astronomer who taught at Cornell University, not too far from where we are. And Carl was an atheist. And his daughter, Sasha Sagan, has written about what her father taught her about life and about death. Sasha remembers being around 7 or 8 and talking about how close she felt with her grandparents, her mother's parents. And then she looked up at her dad and said, you know, why don't I know your parents? And Carl Sagan said, well, they're dead. And Sasha said, well, will you ever see them again? And her father answered that even though he wanted so badly to see his parents again, he had, as he put it, no reason to believe and no evidence that he ever would. So Sasha describes how she descended into a terrifying realization that death is permanent. And suddenly death was constantly on her mind. And Sasha's parents sat down with her and answered all the questions she had as well as they could. And she wrote down in an article essentially what they said to her. They said, you are alive right this second. And that is an amazing thing. You have the pleasure of living on a planet where you have evolved to breathe the air, drink the water, and love the warmth of the closest star. You're connected to the generations through DNA, and even farther back, to the universe. Because every cell in your body was cooked in the hearts of stars. And Sasha goes on, we are star stuff, my dad famously said. And he made me feel that way. My parents taught me that even though it's not forever, because it's not forever, being alive is a profoundly beautiful thing for which each of us should feel deeply grateful. For Sasha, her father's lesson that life is meaningful even without an afterlife or personal God was tested when she was 14, because that's when Carl Sagan was diagnosed with a rare blood disease. And after multiple bone marrow transplants and multiple remissions, he died. And Sasha describes being left with only her father's joyful skepticism as her guide when it came to questions about death. So to find peace with the fact of your own death, or to find comfort, to feel grounded and to avoid despair and live fully while knowing that all the people we love will die, do you need to believe in God to find that kind of peace or acceptance? So let's see, we have examined a number of spiritual or even religious questions this morning. Do you need to believe in God to have reverence, gratitude, and wonder in your life? Do you need to believe in God to live a life of radical generosity and compassion? Do you need to believe in God to find peace with death? I would argue, no. You don't have to believe in God to do these things. I would argue that you don't have to believe in God to live a spiritually whole life. So when an atheist goes to church, and I know a number of you here in this room are atheists, when you go to church, I think you probably go for many of the same or similar reasons that I go to church, to get a firmer grasp on the meaning of life, to replenish your commitment to living compassionately, to feel and notice your reverence and your gratitude, to commit to a life that serves something bigger than your individual self and your individual needs, to face death by living well. There are people who do not believe in God who want to experience all of the things that I just listed in community. That's why an atheist goes to church. So to go back to the question asked in the call to worship, are there ever any atheists in foxholes? I think so. I think an atheist would call out in their last moments of life to something beyond themselves. The people that they love, perhaps, or the immensity and mystery of the stars, as I imagine Carl Sagan may have. But I think there are probably many who live their atheism faithfully to the end. Now you would think, since here in this room we have people who believe in God and people who don't, you would think that a difference in belief about the existence of God or the nature of God would be too much for a religious community to handle without splintering and falling apart. How can we have a faith community in which some people believe in God and some people don't, and many more just aren't quite sure? As Unitarian Universalists, this ability to hold all of our differences in belief in community is in our religious DNA. And it's a tradition that has been passed down for centuries. In 1568, the only Unitarian king in history, John Sigismund, was in power in Transylvania. And King Sigismund had a lot of religious diversity in his kingdom. And he set his close advisors to work figuring out what to do about it. They emerged from their days of debate to propose a document called the Edict of Torda. Now, the Edict of Torda said a few different things, but one quote from this 16th century document reads, "No one shall be reviled for his religion by anyone, according to the previous statutes. And it is not permitted that anyone should threaten anyone else by imprisonment or by removal from his post for his teaching. For faith is the gift of God." So in other words, whatever you believe, it's not your fault. Because faith is a gift that we receive from outside of ourselves, this document says. And today you might like to think instead that faith is that something that rises from our gut, from our heart, our subconsciousness, as well as our reason. So try as you might to use your mind to make yourself believe something. If your heart isn't in it, good luck. For some people, their minds tell them that it's impossible for there to be a God, and yet they cannot help but believe. And for some, they have been raised to believe in God, they want to, and yet they find that they don't. So the essence of the Edict of Torda is carried on today in the fifth principle of Unitarian Universalism, the right of conscience. Each Unitarian Universalist is expected to use their conscience to figure out their personal belief in community. And rather than splintering because of our differences in belief, we decided to say that the answers are under construction. We say that if you engage in community with an open heart, you will learn from others. You can't help it. You will grow from the conversation of truths that you will find in any Unitarian Universalist sanctuary. So you are welcome in this beloved community if you believe in God. You are welcome here if you do not believe in God. And you're welcome if you just aren't quite sure. We honor our ancestors' wisdom that if we embrace our differences in spiritual community, our spirituality will be deepened. Blessed be. Amen.